When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I want to welcome everyone to episode number 28 of Matt Memories from Madison Square Garden, a 50-year retrospective, the early years of the WWWF, the WWF, and the WWE. Madison Square Garden, the mecca of professional wrestling, a building that every wrestler wanted to wrestle in. We record one show a month to coincide with the 50th anniversary of a wrestling house show at Madison Square Garden. And to help us look back at all these shows, a man who went to every wrestling house show at Madison Square Garden for 5 years straight, starting on August 30th, 1971, Mr. Wrestling himself, John Arizzi. John, how you doing, buddy?
How you doing, Tim? It's good to see you again, as always.
It's another day. Just right before we started recording the show, we had an earthquake here in California. It's about 30 minutes away from my house, and it was a 4.7 earthquake, and I was getting ready for the show, and things start shaking, and I was like, okay, maybe this is going to happen during the show. So if we have an earthquake during the show, that will be a first.
Yeah, it would be, and it's, you know, for me, I'd be just here watching you shake, rattle, and roll. And
me freaking out, running out of the room.
I can't even imagine.
So before we start the show, as always, I want to talk to you about how are your other podcasts. I know you're working on other podcasts. The Gibby Show is not with us anymore because Gibby got a job with the Mets. So now you're actually branching out. You're going to be doing other shows. What do you have focused on, especially on your pro wrestling spotlight? People want to know about that.
Yeah, lots going on the podcast front. First, to address the baseball stuff, there will be a couple of new baseball podcasts that I'll be launching. I can't officially announce the titles or names. This weekend, we're actually picking the final names, opening up the social media accounts for the two individuals. So I'll be doing two baseball shows. I'm very excited about them. All I could say is Mets. I'm only going to use that word.
Mets.
But I am to the moon, my friend, about those two new shows. And more, obviously, by the next time we do this, the next episode, which is going to be covering April, those podcasts should be up and running. We want to get them launched right around the start of the season. I'll be heading down to Florida, not once, but twice, to do some baseball work. I got involved with Tunnel to Towers, which is a wonderful organization out of New York, benefiting first responders of 9/11. It's a foundation that pays the mortgages off for those first responders. So we are going down to Port St. Lucie to cut some content with some Mets players. And then it looks like I'm going to be up in New York the last week of March. The season starts for the New York Mets on Thursday, March 28th, I think the date is. So that week we'll be doing some more content for Tunnel. And on the wrestling front, Pro Wrestling Spotlight's original run of 263 shows is now complete. And we taped our last show, which is going out to patrons first, as always, and then the general public. That'll be done way, way after we release this podcast. So this one is going to come out in March. But we have decided to continue covering the history. And what we're going to do is call it Pro Wrestling Spotlight Rewind. And it's going to be a little bit different. We are going to do monthly shows. You know, I might do some specials here and there, but when we launched the show in April of 89, we're going to do like condensed versions. We're going to go, all right, we're going to cover April of 89 and then May, not every single week. So we'll condense them. We'll give the patrons all four monthly episodes at one time on one file. So they'll have the whole condensed thing before they hear the podcast, as we've done previously. But we're also going to do something pretty cool on the first few episodes of the new Pro Wrestling Spotlight Rewind. We're going to... the first show was going to be a rewind of the college years when I did Pro Wrestling Spotlight in Boston at Graham Junior College from 1975-76. And I'm bringing on two of my old college buddies that we haven't all been in the same place at the same time. And even though it's going to be via Zoom, in almost 50 years. So That's going to be fun. And then the second show will be the one show I did at WNYG in 1985 with George Napolitano. And we had Captain Lou Albano, Tully Blanchard on that one. And we got thrown off the air after one episode. So it was supposed to be a weekly show. And it was in 85, just went after WrestleMania one hit and all that explosion. And it was at NYG and the owners of the station, the Hornsteins. We were taping the show. It was live, actually, on a Saturday in October of 85. And the old man, Mr. Hornstein, was in the station at the time we were doing the show. And he just so happened on the speakers in the lobby heard Captain Lou's History of Music, which was quite raunchous. And it was Captain Lou screaming and yelling. And he just said, "What is this show on my station?" And threw us out.
Wow. And just think, it was right after WrestleMania. If he had stayed with it, that could have been a huge show out of the New York
huge
area.
Huge show.
But also, yeah, if he did that, you would never have had your own show.
Well, I mean, no, it was me and George, you know, so who knows? We were just getting into something, you know.
Yeah.
So that was the second rendition of Pro Wrestling Spotlight. And then, obviously, I went back on the air at the same station, WNYG, because Mrs. Hornstein was more interested in the money than the content. And that's the way she was. So she gave me the show, and we went on the air April 9th, 89. And we're going to do it all over again and rewind back. And so that's going to affect patrons as well. We're going to revamp some of the tiers on Patreon. We're going to keep the $5 level because those are people who just want the shows early and have the access to those archives. Because right now we have a $5 level, a $10, a $25, a $50, and a $100 a month. So I'm going to eliminate all but the $5 tier, and I'm going to do a secondary tier, which is going to be a lower tier, probably $15 a month, where you get everything. And then on the top level, at $100 a month, you'll be an executive producer. And that will give that patron an opportunity to appear on the show several times a year.
Sounds great.
And then we're going to launch the, you know, the merchandise portion of it on Patreon as well. It'll give the fans, and I know you and Richie have talked to me about this, like this is what you should do, what you should do. And I'm going to do it. And the producer for that Pro Wrestling Spotlight show, Marsh, Christopher Marsh, but we call him Marsh. That's how he likes to be called. He's got a lot of really cool vintage stuff as well. So we're going to put a little marketplace up there on Patreon and give those patrons the opportunity to purchase this type of stuff, old wrestling magazines, programs, photographs, and action figures, of the, you know, things like that. So all that is going to be in the spring. You know, we're taking a bit of a hiatus. You know, we're taping this show still in early February, even though we're releasing it in March. But for the month of February, we're just going to start getting everything together for the relaunch of Pro Wrestling Spotlight Rewind, and that'll be available to everybody right in, probably in the middle to end of March.
Fantastic. Patreon.com/John Arizzi. Join the family, join the fun, and help us keep the lights on here. That's what it really does. It helps us have a show week after week, or shows week after week. So it really means a lot to us that you're part of the Patreon and you're part of the family, and you're helping us put the show together.
Yeah, and there's very few of us, I mean, out there who really are there to enjoy this type of history, and they love the show. The people who listen love it, and we hope to grow these audiences. And I tell you, every time we put a new show out, Matt Memories from Madison Square Garden, people just love it. You know, they really do. They love hearing about what happened 50 years ago. And I always have to thank you and thank Richie. And this is such a passion project for you guys. And you kind of convinced me to do it when we started this thing off. And I enjoy reminiscing. And it keeps my, as Mick Foley used to say, my memory, he used to call it my memory, my brain exercise. It keeps your memory active,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
So I reminisce, and it brings shit back.
We talk about things, and like when we talk about a show, we're not just talking about the matches, you know, what the arena was like, what the atmosphere was like. It's so different today with the pyro and the music. It wasn't like it back then. The thing that always gets me, the one thing that always pops out, and we've talked this so many times, is there was no guardrail, just like a rope that went around the ring. Like, anybody could jump into it. Anybody can go, and they didn't, even though they did do matches were cut short at times because the fans were getting a little rowdy, which I never, like today, no one ever got that rowdy today. But back then, they'd get people so riled up, they would be afraid they were going to attack the ring.
Right. I've seen guys get billy clubbed by the police back then when they were trying to attack a wrestler. And I have one shot of a cop hitting a guy in the chest with a billy club at Madison Square Garden when he was trying to attack Fred Blassie. I'd love to see that. That's if I could find it, you could see it. But I remember that shot, and I do remember once when King Curtis busted open Gorilla Monsoon when a fan actually ran into the ring and took his shirt off and put it around Monsoon's head to stop the bleeding. You know, so that was a fan who did that.
Yeah,
it's crazy.
Oh, so good. So that's why we do this show, and we thank you guys for being part of the show with us. Let me just do. Richie wanted me to tell you a quick recap. There was no Madison Square Garden house show last month, but the WWWF opened up a major new arena in the New York area. It is on Long Island. It was called Nassau Veterans Memorial Coliseum. It is just 27 miles as a crow flies from Madison Square Garden. What makes this interesting is that it's so close, and it's also the bringing in the people from Long Island. Instead of taking the train, it is now just like right in front of here. It is right here, and they're trying to build up a new audience that would not only go to the garden shows, but maybe if you can't make it to the garden, you can make it to the Long Island show.
Yeah, they did that, and of course, the first show was February in 74, and it wasn't well, you know, it was attended, it was okay attendance, it was typically a little bit more than half the house, 60%, 70% filled, but it took them a while, really, to get a big crowd there, and they started off wanting to run really frequently there, and it ended up being, you know, maybe four times a year, because the garden was where the cash was, the garden was where the big gates were, the garden was the mecca, but them utilizing Nassau Veterans Memorial Coliseum was also a really good opportunity for those fans on Long Island that maybe didn't want to travel into New York City to see a show right there on the island.
The island was a strange place back then. They were really always pushing, even years before this, they were pushing the car. One of the reasons why the Dodgers left Brooklyn is because they wanted to have a place where the train would go. And I think it was Robert Moses that was fighting against it. He was a builder on Long Island. He was an architect for Long Island. And he goes, no, too bad. And they wanted to push people, if they're going to be living outside of Manhattan, get a car. So all the beaches are made for cars. The Coliseum was made for cars. You can't get to the Coliseum, the Nassau Veterans Memorial Coliseum, without a car. There's no trains that go there. The Coliseum was open for years before wrestling got there, but they were pushing the whole aspect of the car and use the car and don't go into Manhattan. So wrestling was trying the same thing. And like you just said, it didn't work out as well as they thought it would.
Yeah, the only Long Island Railroad stop nearest to the Coliseum was Hempstead.
And how far away is that?
Oh, you're talking, 10, 15 minutes. So it wasn't convenient.
So we just want to touch there a little about Nassau Coliseum for the month of February. And before we start today's show, we want to do like a little background into people running the WWWF back in the day. We're starting this new thing on the show. Today's person of the day is Willie Gilsenberg, nicknamed the Bear. He was the WWWF president from 1963 to 1978. He actually died while in office. John, what do you know about Willie?
Willie Gilsenberg was the figurehead president of the Worldwide Wrestling Federation. He didn't have, he wasn't really the president, but he was somebody that Vince McMahon Sr. had done business with. He was a promoter. And yeah, when you say he was the beard, he really was the beard, because everybody thought that Willie was the guy that was running the show. And this went back, really to the early 60s. You know, Willie was a short little old guy with gray hair, and he'd shuffle around, because he was the guy that would, in the middle of the card at Madison Square Garden, he would be, and only the insiders or the super fans would know, he would shuffle out to the ring with the lineup for the next show at the Garden, and then give it to the ring announcer to read to the crowd. So anytime you saw Willie Gilsenberg shuffle from the curtain, the dressing room area, shuffling up to that aisle, it's take him 10 minutes or so to shuffle up there and then give it to friendly Bob Fried or Vince McMahon when he was doing the announcing. He'd just give him the card for the next show, and he'd stay there until the ring announcer read it. And then that would be it. And then you know what was going on next month. So that was kind of the memory I have with him, other than the night I talked about this before when I actually kidnapped him, as I followed him into the Holland Hotel on 42nd Street. The offices are on the second floor. I was trying to get a press pass, a photographer's pass. I went in the elevator with him, and the Capitol Wrestling offices was on floor number 2, and I pushed the last floor in the building, so he had to go all the way up. He was very upset, and I gave him a quick elevator pitch and showed him my press card from Ring Wrestling Magazine and an article that had just been published of mine. And, the elevator door opens on the second floor. floor. He was just like, come with me, kid. Got into the office, and there was Monsoon, Gorilla Monsoon, and Arnie Skolan. Give this kid a press pass. And that was it. And that's how I got in. That was early 1975.
So going back to what Willie used to do, bringing out the card, when would he bring out the card? Is it because, like, I remember a lot of times it would be before the last match or something. It'd be later on in the day,
yes,
in the card, because you have to have those matches, the comeback matches. So, like, for example, if Pedro's wrestling somebody and it was a draw or whatever, Willie would come out sometime after that. Is that correct?
And then after the main event, so to speak, the heavyweight championship match, and it was typically, as you said, it was typically either right before the intermission or it would be right before the final match of the night when they announced what was going to be there the following month.
Okay, so that was Willie's job, and so he knew they had all these things. You look back now and go, oh, it was all, you know, how they're planning everything and putting things together. Let's go back to he has a nickname. I was wondering about this, and you and Richie and myself were talking about this, and I didn't know this at the time. He was nicknamed the Beard, and wrestlers all had nicknames, and I was wondering, and these aren't the nicknames they used in the ring. These are the nicknames they used behind the scenes. So, for example, Lou Thesz was known as the Shoemaker. What's with the nicknames?
I guess when they were, especially because back then there were telegrams going back and forth. Let's say if somebody wanted to use a wrestler in another territory, in another promoter's territory, or if someone was going to drop the title or win the title, they'd use code names.
Oh, interesting. Now, we just like Lou Thesz, we were just saying, was called the Shoemaker. His father was in that profession. He was a shoemaker. So if they say the Shoemaker is going to lose, Shoemaker is going to lose tonight, Lou Thesz.
Yeah, and it's not unlike what they do in the mafia, you know, because every mob guy has a nickname that's not his real name.
True, but I was just thinking, like, wrestlers have nicknames and stuff that, but you know,
yeah,
those names.
Yeah, yeah. These, but see, the wrestling business was like the closed business. It's a secret business, like organized crime. It's secretive, and it's all about kayfabe.
Interesting. I did not know that. Anything else you want to tell me about Willie?
Well, yeah. I mean, he really started as a corner man in boxing in the Jersey area, and then he started managing boxers, started running wrestling shows in Jersey, using the talent from Jack Pfeffer, who was a very famous promoter back then. Toots Mont was another one, and then he assisted Vince Sr. throughout, Vince Sr.'s ascension as one of the top promoters. So he was really instrumental in behind the scenes and really the early beginnings of the Worldwide Wrestling Federation, then known as Capital Wrestling Corporation, and he was in charge of various promotions. And early TV, you know, when they taped it in Washington, D.C., it was always Willie Gilsenberg was always mentioned on those shows, the ring announcer Bob Freed, the play-by-play guy Ray Morgan, and they always talked about the president of the WWWF, Willie Gilsenberg, and it was always actually Vince McMahon Sr.
That's so cool. I love that. We'll hit more of these people in the future. Let's go to tonight's matches. New York City, Madison Square Garden, Monday night, March 4th, 1974, bell time, 8:30. It is a sellout, 22,091. John, what kind of TV buildup was there for this Garden show?
Well, it was really a cool buildup because Volkov, who had come back in after, you know, a few years away, 3-4 years away, and he was Beppo Mongol back then, part of the Mongols tag team managed by Tony Angelo, and they were champions, but Beppo had disappeared, and he comes back as Nikolai Volkov with hair, because Beppo Mongol, and he had a little curly thing coming out of a bald head, a little curl, and the biggest thing was he was with a manager. He was managed at that time by Freddie Blassie, and that was amazing. Fred Blassie coming back into the territory, not as a wrestler, but as a manager. And Freddie had tipped me off in a postcard that he wrote me that he was coming back to the East Coast, to the WWWF, for a long stay. That's the only thing he told me. He didn't say he was coming in as a manager. He just said, I'm coming in for an extended long stay, in that postcard from Japan when he was wrestling there. And he came in. When I saw him on TV as a manager, when they introduced Volkov and I was shocked. And I was happy, and I was elated, because I'm like, all right, now I'm going to get to see Blassie all the time. So that was the buildup. And they really had Volkov squash the opponents, look unbeatable, like the monster he was, tough. And with Blassie in the corner as the mouthpiece, you know, with Freddie's dirty tactics by, you know, stomping on somebody when Volkov threw him out of the ring. It was very exciting. And that was kind of the buildup that I remembered back then. It was a very exciting buildup.
And why he's getting the big shot today is because last month at Madison Square Garden, he beat Gorilla Monsoon. I think it was like 4 minutes, 54 seconds or something like that.
A very quick one, yes.
So a great buildup for Nikolai Volkov in the main event versus Bruno Sammartino later on in today's card. Scheduled bout for today was between Don Leo Jonathan and Ed Sullivan, and it did not take place.
Yeah, I always wondered, and I also wondered about who the heck is Ed Sullivan. I didn't remember him. I thought it was like they did a typo in the program that maybe it was supposed to be Kevin Sullivan.
Yeah,
but it really was a guy named Ed Sullivan. You know, he was there for the really big shoe, but it wasn't. He didn't appear because Jonathan wasn't there. So it may have been a travel problem. You know, who knows what happened, but there was no match between Ed Sullivan and Don Leo Jonathan that night on March the 4th.
Well, let's get into the matches. Match number one, it's a ladies tag team match. Donna Christentello and the women's champion, the Fabulous Moolah, defeated Peggy Patterson and Barbie Doll in a 2 out of 3 falls match.
Yeah, this was kind of a cool match because Barbie Doll was a doll. She was really pretty. I mean, she really was. And she was kind of a newcomer. And my goodness, I mean, she was she had quite the figure on her. And she got a lot of those whistles when she walked down the aisle to get into the ring. And Peggy Patterson, her partner, was not so much a looker. Of course, Moolah never was. And Christentello was a good worker. So it was, you know, best 2 out of 3. But I'll give you a little background on Donna Christentello. First of all, her real name was Mary Alfonsi. She also worked as Princess White Cloud, trained by Moolah, as most of the girls were, debuted in 63, retired in 1991, and she lived with Moolah for over 40 years. And after her wrestling career was over, she worked in the accounting department at Walmart. So there you go. No benefits, no pension, nothing. You're in, you're out, you don't make a lot of money, and boom, where do you go? You go work at Walmart, which is a shame. It really was.
After 40 years in the business.
Yeah. You know, and Tim, not to digress, but I just on the Pro Wrestling Spotlight recent podcast, we talked about that these performers never had this union. They never had the health benefits. And I heard from Evan Ginsberg, who is a real good wrestling historian, very close to Johnny V and so many guys he was involved with as an associate producer for the movie The Wrestler that had come out years ago and did a documentary. He was a producer for 350 days. And he was telling me, you know, Johnny Valiant, who was one of the top guys, one of the best tag teams ever, he never made more than $100,000 a year.
Wow.
And lost his house, died broke.
I remember he was homeless near the end.
Yeah. So, I mean, now, you know, you talk about the billions and billions of dollars. Netflix signing a streaming deal with WWE, $5 billion over 10 years. WrestleMania is going to be huge business. You have a multi-billion dollar company in TKO, which is the parent company now, the WWE, owned by Endeavor, which is a multi-billion dollar company. And even on the other side with AEW, you have the Khan family that are billionaires. Isn't it about time that maybe a fund, especially from WWE, there's a fund that helps their alumni, the people like the Bob Ortons and the Hacksaw Jim Duggins. You know, you go to a convention, you see the same people all the time. This is how these guys make their money. No one has nothing. And it's time. Help these guys out. So anyway, when I learn of something like, you know, Donna Christentello having to work at a Walmart and most of these performers, you know, just dying broke and destitute with nothing to their name after they give their bodies, they put their bodies on the line. It just gets me, fired up like it did 30 years ago when I was talking about this shit back then. Excuse the French.
Nothing has changed a lot. We're talking some wrestlers make money from royalties on maybe videos or toys. But that's not that much.
Today, it's different. But back then, you didn't know what your payoffs were going to be.
No.
You know, the top of the card, you get money. And the bottom of the card, you get it. Your pay-per-view cuts or, you know, your payoffs from pay-per-views. It was all subjective to whoever's in good favor most of the time. So it's really horrible. Now that, you know, things are changed, it's time. Take care of these people. start the benefits. I mean, Endeavor is a $1 billion company. I'm sure all of their employees have 401ks and health benefits up the yin yang and all of that. So what about the people who are actually making you the money? What about the performers? Why are they still independent contractors with no benefits? Why? I mean, so anyway, I could talk about that forever. Well, we'll get back into this tag team match, but that just fired me up. That sparked a little anger inside me. The world champion, the Moolah, we've talked about her. She was trained by Mildred Burke. She got her break as Buddy Rogers' valet, slave girl, Moolah, and she broke up with Buddy because of his constantly pushing for a sexual relationship with her, or alleged. That's kind of what the reason was there. Peggy Patterson, another person in this tag, her real name was Paula Lashier, and she debuted in 1970, retired in 1992. She was trained by both Mildred Burke and Moolah. And finally, Barbie Doll. She also went by the name of Darty Doll, whatever that means, but I'm sure there's a good story behind that. I don't know if we'll ever find it or not. And this was her very first appearance at the Garden. The next day, March 5th, 74, they had the same match. It was at the Baltimore Civic Center. Then on March 6th, they did a TV taping in Hamburg. March 7th, she wrestled at Marblehead, Massachusetts, in a high school gym, and then did the famous Jack Witchie's Arena on March the 8th in a singles match. She lost to Moolah. And then March 9th in Philadelphia, she was replaced by Paula Kay in a tag match. And that was kind of it. I don't know how long of a career she had. I think she was in and out pretty quickly. She was good. She was attractive. And maybe that had something to do with it as well.
You can check out the road right there. So you go from the Garden, and then you got, what do you have? You go into Baltimore after that. So that's a 3-hour drive. Not bad. Hamburg, that's a couple hours. But from Hamburg to Massachusetts, that's a good 4 to 6 hour ride. When you drive up to Maine, that's a couple hours. Then from Maine to Philadelphia, that's a good six hour. This is all on a road. These are all, there were highways, but they weren't what they are today. So this is a lot of road time. Just to get a little glance into what these wrestlers had to deal with at the time going around the circuit.
Yeah, and working TV, that was no money. So, you got maybe $100 a match on TV. That was it. The house shows, what was she getting there? What were they getting at that? $200? You pay your own trains, you pay your own gas, you pay your own hotel,
yeah. You
pay your own rental car. So anyway, I don't want to I'll digress again, and I'll go off on a tangent again. So let's
All
move
right.
on.
Let's go to match number two. Mr. Fuji defeated Johnny Ross in 10 minutes, 14 seconds.
Yes, Mr. Fuji against the unpredictable Johnny Raj. Typical match, 10 minutes 14. Johnny, certainly a mainstay for so many years in the WWF and other territories. His real name, John Rodriguez. He's still alive, known as the unpredictable Johnny Rods. And that was a name that stuck to him. And I'm going to have to say, I'm going to take credit for naming him the unpredictable, because I did a story on him for Ring Wrestling Magazine, and that was the title of that story, and then it kind of stuck.
Wow. I didn't know that. That's an exclusive. So you gave Johnny Rods, the unpredictable Johnny Rods, his name, you think?
Well, I didn't know they were going to use it that way. I just wrote an article because he was unpredictable. He'd do anything, and that was kind of the lead masthead or the lead opening line. And the story was just called The Unpredictable Johnny Rods.
Wow. I love that. And let's look into Johnny Rods as a wrestler. He became more of a jobber later on. And why I even mention that is because when I was watching TV as a kid, if you saw Johnny Rods in a ring, you knew whoever was wrestling him was the good guy.
Yes, he was a consummate heel, great heel, and he used to get heat from the fans. But he also had a nice run out in Los Angeles when he worked for the LaBelles out there, and he changed his name to Jobber Ruik. And I believe he even won one of them battle royals out there, one of the annual battle royals. So they gave him quite a push out there in Los Angeles. He was also known as the Arabian Wild Man. He had kind of a chic gimmick in the LaBelle territory. He wrestled the Super Medico number 2. He wrestled as El Shafto. He did make his debut in 1965. He retired in 1997, so he had a wonderful career. His first Madison Square Garden appearance was in 1967 on July the 31st when he got a win over Frank Holtz. And Holtz was known as the Fighting Cop. He moonlit as a part-time wrestler from 63 to 76. Getting back to Johnny, Johnny trained students for over 30 years at a Gleason's gym in Brooklyn. And some of the names that Johnny had a hand in training: Tommy Dreamer, Taz, Devon, Bubba Ray, and Big Dick Dudley, Bill DeMott, even SD Jones, and even a name that was a little notorious, Vince Russo.
Wow.
And yeah, I remember that because I was partners with Russo at that time. We had just launched Pro Wrestling Spotlights in WEVD in our newsletter. And then Vince called me up and he was like, I want to do a deal. I want to do a trade deal with Johnny Rods. And I was like, okay, what do you want to do? He goes, well, you know, he's got the wrestling school and I want to give this a shot and I want to be a wrestling manager. I was like, are you kidding? And I was kind of like a little, why do you want to be a wrestling manager for? We're doing, you know. But listen, it was okay. He formed a great relationship with Johnny. And but anyway, you know, Russo was only in the business for a month, and he was trying to break in as a manager.
Wow.
So he always had higher aspirations.
Good for him. Good for him. All right,
absolutely.
And Johnny Rods, he did make it into the WWE Hall of Fame, which is pretty nice.
Yeah, I think it was 1996, actually.
96. Let's go to match number three. Professor Toru Tanaka defeated Jose, we call him the Killer, Gonzalez in 8 minutes, 59 seconds.
Yeah, Tanaka defeated Gonzalez, and of course we always refer to him as the Killer. I mean, you know, no respect there at all. And Tanaka, still a mainstay, but with the push they were starting to give Jose, it was a little surprising to see Tanaka get the win over him.
Let's go on to match number four, and I think we've seen this match before. I'm not too sure. Tell me if we have, John. Match number four, Chief J Strongbow defeated Captain Lou Albano, who was subbing for Stan Stasiak, via countout in 4 minutes, 35 seconds, when Captain Lou left ringside. Didn't we see this a few years ago?
We saw it many times.
Okay.
It was what they did. I mean, it was just kind of a quick match. They always had this big feud. And with Stasiak not there, I guess he volunteered to go in and, you know, cut himself open, do a quick little job, run back to the locker room. And that was the way Albano did his matches for the most part. You know, Captain Lou, such a wonderful, wonderful man. Just got to know him. He was just incredible guy. What a great performer. He passed away in 2009 at the age of 76 from a heart attack. He had a long career, Albano. I mean, 1953, he made his debut. Became a manager in late 69 with the Crusher Verdue, who had this big barrel chest. I never forget, like, he and Albano. When I saw Albano coming as a manager, because I always saw him as kind of a semi-jobber on TV over the years, and also with his tag team partner Tony Altomori as the Sicilians, I was familiar with Albano. But when he started managing, it was really cool. Verdue had just immigrated from Spain, and he didn't speak very good English, so they put Albano with him as a mouthpiece. And Albano's promo skills were probably better than almost anybody back then. So great memories there.
Was he one of the first managers in the WWF that would be like a manager and then he would wrestle and be a manager, be a wrestler? Because I thought like Freddie Blassie would do that, but we never saw that out of Blassie. Once he became a manager, he was just a manager. But Captain Lou used to go back and forth.
Blassie rarely took a bump. Once in a while, Andre would hit him, you know, and Blassie would stumble or whatever, or, you know, but he didn't. But the thing about Albano, he wasn't really the first manager to take a bump. Tony Angelo, who managed even, I think, Ivan Koloff for a while, and the Mongols, he took bumps now and then.
Well, what I mean before... is, did he get into a match? Like, Albano would always be part of...
Tony Angelo was a wrestler, too. He did wrestle.
So, like, what I'm saying is, did Tony Angelo, they say, okay, Tony Angelo's going to be in a tag team match, or Tony Angelo's going to be against Chief J Strongbow. Did he ever do that? You know, I know taking a bump, just like getting punched in the head, where you're not supposed to be on the ring.
No. Angelo actually went in the ring.
Okay.
And he might have been in some six-man tags with the Mongols back then, or even with Koloff. Even Bobby Davis, if my memory serves correct, I think Bobby Davis and Buddy Rogers also teamed up once or twice. So, you know, even though Albano was the first guy really to get in there, semi-regularly as a wrestler, I don't think he was the first one to do that. And then, of course, Albano did so many other things.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, if you look back, WrestleMania, the whole putting the Rock and wrestling together was Captain Lou Albano. We've talked about this before, how he met Cyndi Lauper on a plane ride, and then Cyndi Lauper actually put him in one of her videos. It was Girls Just Want to Have Fun, her big hit. And then from there, they I don't know how they turned it around and brought it into wrestling, but they did. And that created the Rock and Wrestling.
Yeah, that was really the build up to WrestleMania 1. And Cindy and Albano, after being introduced by Mickey B from WNYG on the airplane, them coming back from Puerto Rico and put them two together. And then David Wolf, who was Cindy's manager at the time and eventually became her husband, and, you know, they just had a great idea. And Cindy was hot. And that music video that she put Albano in exploded. So it was quite a run with Cyndi Lauper, and what a great fun music video to this day. And Albano appeared on a couple other music videos of hers. And of course, all of that big angle, that build up, the Rock and Wrestling connection, it was great. And Albano was also an actor.
Yeah, you know, with the Rock and Wrestling connection, what was so great about that is MTV was taking off at that time. So anytime you play the video or they would tie it into wrestling. And I remember seeing Roddy Piper. I remember seeing Hulk Hogan and Mr. T on MTV. So it was mass marketing.
Sheik.
The Iron Sheik. Everybody was on MTV, which just promoted it more and more. And the whole thing with Moolah and Wendy Richter, it was because of Cyndi Lauper and Lou Albano. And it just, you just don't know where these things start. And here it is. Captain Lou Albano started this big thing, and it just grew and grew and grew and grew.
Yeah. And certainly the acting was great. 1986, he was in the movie Wise Guys, one of my favorites. And in 96, they finally got him into the Hall of Fame.
Was his name Mr. Roccavano?
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Roccavano.
Thank you, Mr. Roccavano.
Thank you, Mr. Roccavano. All right.
I love it when he was cutting his toenails and, like, you know, hit somebody in the head.
It's Danny DeVito and Joe Piscopo.
Yes.
Yeah.
Great movie.
Great movie. You got to say Wise Guys. Really good movie. If you can find it streaming, definitely go check it out. Let's go to match number five. WWF Tag Team Champions Dean Ho and Tony Garea defeated Larry Henning and Stan Stasiak, substituting for Mike McCord, in the best 2 out of 3 falls matches, 2 to 0. First fall going to the champions by disqualification in 14 minutes, 20 seconds. And fall number 2 going to the champions in 8 minutes, 25 seconds.
Yeah, so this was a little switcheroo with McCord not showing up. Stasiak gets plugged in into that match, which, of course, put Albano in that match with Strongbow. So it made a lot of sense at that time. And let's not forget, you know, Stasiak was the WWF heavyweight champion, and he held it for, you know, a week. December 1st to December 10th, and his single bout record at the Garden is 6 wins, 19 losses, 3 draws. His first win in the Garden came in his 14th appearance there, and his record in tag team bouts, 0 wins, 10 losses, and 1 draw. Kind of surprising.
Yeah. Yeah, we always talk about Stan Stasiak as someone they could have done more with. Stan Stasiak looked like everyone's father, pretty much. In the 70s, earlier than the 70s, because your dad would be a child of the 50s, so he always had the greased back hair and stuff. My dad had a similar haircut. Remember growing up seeing dad in the greased back hair and everything. That reminded me definitely of Stan Stasiak, maybe a little Nick Bockwinkle in there.
Yeah, my dad had the same type. He would just, like, slick the hair back and comb it, and that was the time, man.
That was the look. Let's go to match number 6. Pedro Morales defeated Otto Van Heller in 7 minutes, 51 seconds.
Yeah, Morales, and, you know, it was kind of strange to see him so low on the card, and Heller, so it wasn't a big thing. He still got a nice pop from the crowd. And Otto Van Heller playing the German gimmick, the Nazi gimmick. Thought he was going to get a big push at one time, but he didn't. His real name, Mike Hall.
And match number 7, which is really cool to see this, how quick this all came about. Stemming off of last month, Nikolai Volkoff defeated Gorilla Monsoon in like 4 minutes, 54 seconds. And the next month, he's against the champion, WWF champion Bruno Sammartino, fought Nikolai Volkoff to a curfew draw at 53 minutes, 7 seconds.
Yeah, it was Blassie leading Volkoff into the ring. They had a heck of a match, exchanging wrestling holds, bear hugs, Nikolai with the backbreaker. So it was back and forth, and they really knew how to work well together. The synergy between those two guys in the ring was really, really good, and it kept fans on the edge of their seats. And the longer the match went, you were hoping Bruno would get the victory, but Volkoff fought really, really hard, and then it finally ended up in that curfew draw, 53-07. Volkoff, of course, a dear friend of mine. He's no longer with us. Joseph Petruvac was his real name, and he also was known, as we talked about previously, as Beppo Mongo. And October 23rd, 1970 is Beppo. He had the shot at Bruno's title, and it took Bruno about 13 minutes, 30 seconds to pin Beppo. And the attendance that night, 1970, was 17,491, and certainly was a rough opponent to carry for 53 minutes into that into that match.
And the reason why there was a curfew, there's a time curfew of 11 p.m. at Madison Square Garden. Here's some other famous curfew matches, not all at the Garden. One of the most famous is Shea Stadium shut down Bruno Sammartino versus Pedro Morales. That was September 30th, 1972, went 65 minutes. Then we got August 27th, 1973, Pedro versus Stan Stasiak went 53 minutes. August 26, 1974, Bruno and Chief Jake Strongbow went to 11 p.m. curfew with the Valiant Brothers. No time was listed. And July 12, 1975, Bruno and George Steele went to a 45-minute match with 11 p.m. curfew.
Yeah, so there were those curfew draws, which I never really enjoyed. I mean, you know, once a match was that long, you knew when that clock was like a 10:45, you were saying, this is going to the draw.
And you had to get out of there. That was the whole thing. People had to get out of there. They had to go run, catch the train, because if they didn't catch, what train was it exactly? It was 11 p.m. curfew.
11:10.
So you had 10 minutes to get to the train, and if you missed it, how long would you have to wait?
Oh, about an hour.
An hour. And it's not like, hey, I'm in Manhattan for another hour. No, it's in Manhattan. It's 11 o'clock
at
night.
You're in Penn Station where it was hot and those big giant fans and it stunk of urine and all of that. I mean, it was just horrible. Nothing was open that late. You couldn't even get a slice of pizza or anything. I mean, so you got to make that 11:10 train, Tim. Had to do it.
If you miss it, you're stuck there for an hour, and it is not a good hour to be stuck there. So, John, how would you review this show?
For me, it was really, I was very excited about it from start to finish. And it was also because now I was entrenched with the Bill Baker tickets in the first row. My photography was starting to get better. Ooh. And even on this show, I took an 8mm camera with me. It was one of the last matches that I filmed as well as took pictures of. And that was Bruno and Volkov. So I do have that on 8mm as well. But yeah, it was kind of like, I remember shooting some really good shots of Morales and Otto von Heller that night. And I was starting to develop my chops.
If you've been in the first five rows of anything, it just is a different match.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. The closer you are, the better it is.
And no matter how bad the match is, you're into it because you're that close.
You're into it because you're right up front.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so it was amazing just to be able to do that each and every month from here on going forward and really develop the chops as a photographer and then started making some money doing it.
Fantastic. Our next Garden show is April 1st, 1974. And there will be actually two Garden House shows, April 1st, 1974 and April 29th, 1974. Headlining the April 1st show, Nikolai Volkov. Off getting a return match against Bruno's WWF heavyweight title.
Yeah, certainly look forward to those April shows and Bruno and Volkov again. And they had that nice run because it really kind of leads up into even June when Volkov and Blassie actually put the tights on against Bruno and Strongbow. So there's a lot of Nikolai Volkov to talk about with Freddie Blassie over the next few shows.
Definitely looking forward to it. Once again, we want to shout out Scott Teal and Crowbar Press.
Yes, we do. As always, we couldn't do this, and Richie couldn't do all the research without the Bible, as I call it, for this show anyway, Wrestling in the Garden, Crowbar Press. Scott Teal put together a fabulous book, reference guide, The Battle for New York, Work, Shoots, and Double Crosses. So go to crowbarpress.com and get a copy of this thing, because it covers over 100 years of wrestling at the Garden. Amazing stuff.
It is a great book. It is our Bible. And as we said, our next card is April 1st, 1974. Anything else, John?
No, I mean, that's really it. Another great show. I want to thank you, of course, Tim, as always, for putting this thing together, doing the production side of it. Richie Garcia, I mean, he just loves it so much. The research that he does, putting each and every show together, it kind of is a spark to my memory when I see it and I get the notes and we go over it. We always have a pre-production meeting, so it's just kind of fabulous. And couldn't do it without you guys, obviously, in the book by Scott Teal. You know, all I do out of this is I provide the memories. And not all of them are accurate. My memory is what it is. So, and I'm going to make a correction here from even earlier on in this show. I was thinking Volkov and Blassie, seeing them on TV, that preceded like when Gorilla Monsoon fought Volkov for 4 minutes. So the buildup that I was talking about, I'm talking about Blassie and Volkov debuting and then going into the Garden to fight Monsoon first, beating him in 4 minutes.
It's still amazing to me how quick the buildup is. Now you see on TV, there are very, very quick buildups. But for the time, normally what would happen is you bring someone in the territory and he starts working people, working his way up. And he wouldn't just go against Gorilla Monsoon. He'd take on other people. And it would be a 2 to 3, 4 month period before he gets to Bruno.
Yeah, sometimes it was like that for sure. You know, you'd go through the rungs on the ladder to keep going up till you hit Bruno. But sometimes there was a guy like John Tolos who came in for one TV tape and he got the main event.
Nikolai Volkov is somebody that's going to bring in and they're going to use. For a long time.
Yeah, so, you know, some of them, especially if they were known entities, like, and we'll get into the Killer Kowalski stuff, because Killer, you know, really, his April matches, like April 29th was that match with Bruno. I mean, Kowalski was on TV 3-4 weeks, boom, he's right in the main event, because he had a long history with Bruno.
Gotcha. Oh, I'm so looking forward to this. For John Arizzi and Richie Garcia, I'm Tim Poutre. We'll see you next time.